Good morning, Santa Cruz. This is Becky Johnson, and you're listening to Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides from Jail. This is 96.3 FM, Free Radio, Santa Cruz, where the First Amendment still works. On today's show, I'm going to be playing an extensive interview that I conducted with Robert up in County Jail 8. And those of you who are unfamiliar with what the case is, Robert, or Bathrobes Pierre himself, is currently serving a 59-day sentence in San Francisco for having served bagels and soup to homeless people. I met with Robert on June 28th in the Glamour Slammer, where he is currently housed, and conducted an extensive interview, which I will be airing both today's show and also on Friday's show as well. So listen up for the following interview. And I just entered the...
Yes, you do.
No,
thank you.
Okay, this is June 28th, and I'm here at San Francisco County Jail, where I'm about to be escorted up to interview Robert Narzkhan in jail, County Jail 8, where he is serving a 59-day term for having served bagels and soup to homeless people. And so I'm waiting for my escort as I speak. I have checked all my equipment. I was not allowed to videotape, so this interview will be done entirely on audio tape. So how many people are in this jail?
I think we've got about 360.
Is it pretty much that population most of the time, or does it vary a bit?
David?
So how long has this jail been open?
What's it? 95? November 95?
So it's a pretty new jail then. I've heard it's an unusual design.
Right, it is. It's direct supervision, so it's everything is really modernized.
And that there's less incidents of violence in here, is that true?
Yes. Much less. For the simple fact that since it's being a direct supervision, you hold people more accountable. The deputies are moving around in the dormitory enough to where you're having a lot of close contact with the inmates. Seems to lower the risk of anything happening because you're present. So
that's been the problem in the past, is that inmates would just be sort of left on their own and get beat up by other inmates?
In some cases, probably. Mm-hmm. I've only worked direct supervision, and I haven't experienced that.
Oh. Okay, thank you. You're Deputy Westfield? Is that
right. How
you're addressed?
Right.
I see that there are a lot of women guards here. Is it?
We have not enough women, really. But it's probably about 12 on day watch. There's three different watches, and each watch has its amount of deputies.
Riding on the exercise bike. It's a new you.
Hi. Good to see you here. Glad to see you made your way past the authorities. Becky, Frank. Frank, Becky.
Hi, Frank.
How you doing, Becky? Frank?
Yeah, I talked to you on the phone, right?
Well, you're the one I spoke to, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to meet you. Good to see you at DJ in person, huh?
Hey.
What is this?
Yep.
Oh, no, man.
electronic device to escape.
Hello, Becky.
Hi.
This is the interview. Good to see you.
Hi. You prepared for the long haul?
When you have a deputy, you really rate, Ken. Usually have a deputy separating you with, we could do our thing in here. How you been? Good to see you. We should shake hands.
Right. Oh, yeah, well, I was at Andy Rose's last night, and he didn't tell me how long I was going to be in here.
Good, well, we'll stretch it out.
Yeah, well, like I said, I'm prepared to really stretch it if need be. Plenty of questions.
Good.
It's kind of quite a little trip to get in here.
Really? What was the process with you?
Oh, no, when I got here, they were very amenable and lots of checking sheets, and they had looked over all my equipment and everything. But they promised to store it safely, and I suppose they're good at security here. They're kind of their profession.
It's their business. Does this thing work? Are you sure it's working?
Yeah.
Is it going too slow again, or?
I don't think so. I think it's doing fine.
The trusty machine.
So they were serving oatmeal and coffee with this lovely soy milk they put in the coffee. It makes it look pretty unappetizing. I brought for your comments.
Right.
The next cartoon that you've only heard about.
Oh, this cheesy cartoon.
Yeah, right? There it is.
The man whom you spoke to on the phone, no less.
Steve DiCinzo. And that's his take on the farmer's market situation down in San Cruz.
Right. And the implication is that the farmer's market, of course, your readers have seen this cartoon in the Metro Santa Cruz of last week. And it's, of course, it's a four-part cartoon that describes, has a picture of a farmer talking about how good organic produce is, but it does attract pests, and then you have to learn to live with them or do without them, but keep moving and hope the damn things don't follow, and then suddenly in the last quadrant you see the farmer's market guy moving and a bunch of deadheads sort of lingering about. In fact, it's not the farmer's market who has any objection to transients or deadheads or homeless people or street people who are hanging out there. It's the downtown association which wants to control the farmer's market. In fact, wanted to remove the farmer's market. They moved it onto the main street, and then they moved it off the main street off to the side. Now they wanted to remove it entirely. So this is a really deceptive cartoon, as well as being a bigoted one, because it does not really accurately pinpoint who doesn't like deadheads, transients, and homeless people. Obviously, the main person that doesn't like them is, of course, DiCinzo himself.
And, of course, there's the implication that organic produce attracts deadheads or transients.
Right, food attracts deadheads and transients, which is the very reason that I'm supposedly in jail. The rationale behind the arrests was that I'm working for a group, Food Not Bombs, that sort of encourages homeless people. They don't say this, of course, but in my mind, that's the reason that they went after Food Not Bombs and began arrested over 1,000 people in the course of 8 years, eventually convicting one poor slob. So I see you have your dreaded notebook with you there,
yeah.
Becky.
Yeah, it's getting filled up quick here, too. Yeah, let me start. I have actually prepared questions for this interview. And some of these, some of the free radio listeners would be familiar with some of your responses on some of these issues. So, you know, go make a cup of coffee or something if it gets too boring.
Hey, I'll just sit here and
suffer with it. And okay, the first question I want to ask you is, Robert, do you consider yourself a prisoner of conscience?
Sure. There's no really legitimate reason why I'm in here. I don't know if I'd say a prisoner of conscience or simply a prisoner who's jailed under an unjust order. It's not even a law. It's a concocted injunction that is not even being enforced and was only enforced in terms of being taken to trial in one case, mine. So it's unjust. Conscience, insofar as much of what Food Not Bombs does, is that it puts out food and literature. It's much, and indeed what was pointed out at the sentencing hearing was that the literature that it puts out, one of the pieces was the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And that declaration...
Well, that's a pretty dangerous piece of literature there.
Definitely extremely seditious literature. And in fact, many of the times Keith McHenry has been arrested, he has been arrested for distributing literature, although the charges against him, and he's probably the most notorious Food Not Bombs figure in the pantheons of Food Not Bombs history here in Santa Cruz, he's been arrested and charged with felonies. I'm only here on a misdemeanor. For essentially giving out literature. The actual charges have been assault with a deadly weapon, and that situation happened when he walked into a supervisor's office, as he does every week, to give away literature to the supervisors. And the supervisor secretary, angry, slammed the door on him, and slammed the door on actually the older man who was with him, a man who has since died. And to protect him, Keith put out his arm to stop the door. It hit the glass, severing one of Keith's arteries, and glass flew through the room. They then accused him of felony assault with a deadly weapon.
Wow. That's a pretty big stretch there.
But the point was, yeah, I mean, of course, it was all preposterous.
He was a victim of assault. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Patrick Ring outside the courtroom in Santa Cruz.
The San City Hall Sleepers Vigil.
Yeah, after he got assaulted by five cops, and then they all charged him with assault. I guess being assaulted or assaulting are the same.
Right.
You would have to conclude that would be a corrupt system that would conclude that.
Well, he was, the point I'm making was that not just that they committed, I believe the charges were concocted in both cases, though I understand Patrick, whose temper is legendary, but indeed was justified in his outburst because he was being harassed by the deputy.
And pepper gassed.
After the, they could see you through the glass, you better watch out. Mm-hmm. Not much I'd like to touch it.
This is kind of a companion question. Do you consider yourself a political prisoner?
Conscience, in that sense, that what I'm doing with Food Not Bombs was not simply giving out food, but making a statement about the right to give out free food, making a statement about the skewed priorities of the federal government and the skewed priorities of the city government in harassing people who are sleeping outside, harassing people who are trying to get a good meal, misrepresenting the condition of homeless people in San Francisco, allegedly to claim that they are, at least adequately enough taken care of, that any homeless person that's found, nestling under an overhang downtown can legitimately be arrested, as thousands were cited or arrested at more than 39,000 tickets were issued in the last 3 years and dismissed eventually by District Attorney Hallinan. Yeah, that is true.
That's here in San Francisco.
Here in San Francisco, in the city limits, and under the administration of Mayor Frank Jordan, though unfortunately the rate of ticketing under Willie Brown has not gone down. It's gone up, although it's not clear whether new cases are being prosecuted by District Attorney Hallinan. That's not clear yet.
Mm-hmm. I hear a little beehive of activity over there.
Yeah, this is the you're no doubt getting certainly once over by a number of people here. This is the ward. They're all men. There are 90 prisoners, all of them dressed in orange jumpsuits. The only women you see on the ward are medical workers and occasionally a legal worker. And then the occasional intrepid reporter, actually the only intrepid reporter that's ever made it in the history that I know under the ward has been you.
Oh, wow.
So I want to congratulate you on
thank you.
Getting in there.
Yeah, with my telephone skill.
Yeah, you did. Not just that, you walked in, and that is, and then you ignored the deputy who was trying to distract you and get you to leave until she finally gave up. You didn't even notice.
No, I didn't notice.
That's very good. That was very clever. She found me, as you may hear through the earlier part of this tape, on the exercise bike. I was attempting to work off some of the heavy food they give you here on the ward.
Yes, I hear this. All this rich food.
Oh, you get French sauces, and it's pheasant under glass, and
caviar.
Oh, caviar is one of the favorite dishes here on the F Pod ward here where we're sitting.
That seems to interest people quite a bit. How is the food? And some of the other prisoners that I've talked to, not necessarily at County Jail 8, but at other jails, both in Santa Cruz and throughout the state, there seems to be a universal complaint that not only is the food very poor in quality, but that there's not enough of it. Do you find that to be true here?
Many people complain about that, particularly those who want to engage in true bodybuilding. There's a lot of, at least half the inmates really work out all the time. You'll see guys doing push-ups, they'll be doing pull-ups, stretch-ups, up-ups, I don't know what. In fact, I've been invited to join them with great respect by a man named Ramirez, who is the Spanish translator. He's quite a guy. Every morning he translates for the... The deputies have a meeting. Actually, there's several pod meetings a day, and his translations happen. He's a very kind of colorful fellow. He's very self-contained. There's great dignity, and also kind of carries himself well. He's invited me to join. He said I should do push-ups every day, that I could soon be 40 or 50 a day, and I can become very buff. He just put it that way. Good for your health.
So it's your, kind of your personal trainer here.
Well, he's offered to be my personal trainer. I do a little working out on the bike, as you found, but that is so far that and jumping up and down out of my bunk are my major exercise periods during the day.
So you haven't really gone through a major lifestyle change.
I'm trying to avoid the deconditioning that happens in prison and the dreaded change of perspective, nor have I changed my sexual preference in spite of rumors to the contrary. I continue to appreciate women rather than men.
Stuck in that heterosexual rut.
I am. I apologize to our gay and bisexual listeners for the narrow road I'm currently following, but who knows? You know, the years stretch ahead, you never can tell what's next.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I wanted to ask you something about your background. Do you come from a politically active family?
Well, to some extent. My father was politically active in the Democratic Party. He was a lawyer for a while, and he worked in the Bonneville Power Administration, and he was he's sort of a political pamphleteer. He used to write a lot of limericks for election campaigns, and a lot of the people he knew, or a number of the people he knew, a few of the people he knew, let's not exaggerate, went on to political power. His roommate in college became a senator. He wrote a book too. My father's written a book about Senator Norris. Or am I thinking of somebody else? My father and I have not always been that close, so I wish to misrepresent him. But he still is active in politics. I got a letter from him today, and he sent me a kind of a fistful of clippings. He's concerned about particularly issues of world health and world hunger, although he's been very skeptical of Food Not Bombs and organizations that eschew, I should say, that reject traditional political solutions. He thinks that
they're too anarchist.
Well, he feels that they don't make a big enough impact. You have to have a national impact.
There's some ambient sound here.
Yes, that's the elevator music of the F Pod. The occasional
no music.
Juan Ramirez. Will Juan Ramirez? That sort of thing. that happens. All right. Count time, gentlemen, count time. You know, things of that sort that you get regularly. Anyway, Steve, that's my father, Steve. He's very savvy politically. He follows the local politics very well, and he's interested in helping. I think he's working on some limericks for Spanish, Mexican not election campaigns, but he wants to get a Spanish singer to sing some song about, is it world hunger? Is it about methyl bromide? I'm not sure. His causes are not my causes directly. I mean, I'm definitely concerned about world hunger, but he sees the way to resolve this is through sort of liberal organizations and influencing government policies through elections. And these aren't necessarily wrong, but the trouble is with the Democrats and the Republicans, you maintain this incredibly corrupt and unresponsive system where the mass of resources goes to a few people, and the major emphasis is not on helping people in medical care and, you know, meeting human needs, but on maintaining the status quo, or worse, giving more power to those who happen to have some wealth in their hands at the moment.
So how did you become politically active?
You mean politically active in terms of what I do now?
I'm wondering how you got started.
My father had quite an influence in terms of throwing a lot of issues at me when I was younger. But I became interested because I spent a lot of time on the streets myself when I was younger. And I saw how basically unfair people were treated. I was jacked up by a San Francisco police officer when I was 17. It was a really frightening experience. I said something like, "But don't I have any rights?" And this, of course, and enraged the cop, who just really went off on me and frightened the hell out of me. And, you know, I was a sensitive kid. And it was all that San Francisco cop's fault, I think we could say. You find me here today? The answer is, don't scare timid, precocious 17-year-old youths or reap the world.
So that was kind of a turning point for you, that the world is not the rosy place that you might have thought it was before that?
I don't know if it was a turning point. It didn't so much change my perspective. You know, I would say more it changed my, emotionally, it caused an impact on me more than anything else. And I also became, when I was younger, I was much more alienated from society. I'm still quite alienated, but I was very much a loner, and I was frequently being hassled by police because I lived in single-room occupancy hotels in different places like Los Angeles and Berkeley and San Francisco or Portland, other cities. It became a matter of kind of conscience to me to resist such invasions of my privacy and violations of my rights, and I tended to see that as something which other people should also be supported in resisting. So in a way, I'm kind of a civil libertarian. I'm more than a person who wants, let's say, food supply to everybody. I'm glad to feed people, but I'm more interested in their rights. And one might say, well, what good is it, your right, if you don't have anything to eat? And that's, of course, a frequent question that people who are living in third world countries pose, and it's a very legitimate question. But it's not a question that I'm directly involved with, because I'm more concerned with the issues of human rights and society, you know, the right not to be arrested or harassed or abused while you're looking for your dinner, I guess.
So who've been your role models, people that you've admired?
I've admired prisoners of conscience during the Second World War, Quakers who, other A.J. Mustey, peace activists who resisted the Second World War and were in jail for it. I admired revolutionaries who violently resisted abuses in their home countries, ranging from American revolutionaries to Haitian revolutionaries to Cuban revolutionaries to even Polish revolutionaries, you know, before they became the leaders of the country.
And what writers have influenced you?
Writers? I liked Bukowski. You ever read Charles Bukowski? He's a kind of a nitty-gritty alcoholic type writer who writes a lot about boozy situations and lower income scenes for single males. He's a sort of a sexist pig. And, I like Howard.
So sexist pigs are kind of role model for you?
No, not so much a role. Well, perhaps, unconsciously. But I like the way you describe the pains and the passions of people who have very little, and people who are anguished loners and so forth. I liked Hunter J. Thompson's writing. I liked Howard Fast, who was a communist for for a while and wrote a lot about revolutionaries and heroes of the left, Sacco and Vanzetti and things like that, people of that sort.
So do you consider yourself foremost a writer, a radio journalist, or an activist?
I don't really think of myself in terms of any one role. I'm just sort of an all-around troublemaker.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you do all of those things, but which do you identify with most?
Well, it's useful to have a microphone, as you know, to go around and gather documentary evidence from people who like to know that they're being, their stories are being given a wider parlance on the air. Writing is often a more effective way of doing this than radio, because you can, I find, for example, you can learn more from time-wise in 5 minutes by reading than you can listening to a radio show, so that seems useful, excuse me. But in terms of any of this, it's most useful eventually, if you want to make changes, you have to be willing to put yourself out there, I've found, and if you don't risk jail in some cases, it doesn't mean going to jail is necessarily a good thing. I don't really think that jail does much good, and or necessarily that I'm having my doubts about peaceful nonviolence, not that I suggest, you know, warlike violence, but I'm saying that the idea of symbolic nonviolence should be seen, I think, as a tactic that people should use, and that there are other tactics as well that attempt to confront the massive powers of the government that are, you know, growing daily in terms of the vicious drug war, which is really a war against people, and the war against the poor. Activists, you need to be an activist in order to encourage others to help stop the changes that are happening, the bad changes, and to set the stage for the good changes. I don't want to say create the good changes, but at this stage in history, I don't see a lot of good changes immediately on the horizon.
So it's more to
sort of a holding,
provide an opposition to.
If you spark enough people to anger, legitimate anger in terms of resistance to unjust authority, where the authority is stealing your right to be close to your loved one, let's say,
mm-hmm.
stealing your right to a free meal, or a meal that you might want to work for, or a meal you might want to share with someone else, all these things, then you encourage people to do this, and I think you probably saw that as you walked in, where you saw people, you know, sharing free food, doing exactly what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
and it's still illegal. The injunction that under which I was arrested, which was made final in 1994, it's still out there, and those people are saying, arrest me too. I'm willing to take the same chance, and even though I see that these people have put one man in jail, that's going to stop me.
Clean up time, clean up, back to your beds, clean up time now.
Wow, Mr. Personality there.
Very straightforward approach to the discipline problem. Do what we say, or go to jail. In this case, the jail is inside the jail. You get locked in, locked down,
so
locked
the
up.
Jail in the jail.
There is, yeah, you get, there are locked rooms upstairs that they put you in, which I have not yet had the pleasure of visiting, but who knows, it could be the next stop on my whirlwind tour here of the downtown San Francisco jail system.
So how did you first become involved with Food Not Bombs?
I became involved with Food Not Bombs in the summer of 1988, when I was supporting the rights of homeless people in Santa Cruz and San Francisco, particularly in vehicles. And there was a group called the Vehicular Residents Association in San Francisco, which had formed around hate in response to the Golden Gate Park harassment of homeless people, which essentially began as a police department-initiated campaign in the winter of 1988, when Art Agnos, the new mayor, took office to embarrass Agnos. Agnos was a liberal, and the police department wanted to embarrass him, so they started harassing vehicles. Agnos, who had been elected as a liberal, put a moratorium on the harassment of people living in their vehicles, but only for 6 months. And a bunch of lawyers and right-wing real estate developers in the hate, called the Coal Valley Improvement Association, began a pressure-writing campaign to smear Agnos as some sort of hippy-dippy, liberal bleeding heart who was allowing the city to go to rack and ruin by stopping the police from their legitimate job of arresting people who were eating ham sandwiches in their cars after 7 o'clock at night. Which is illegal, by the way, in San Francisco under a 1971
It's
ordinance.
Illegal to eat in your car after 7 o'clock
Actually,
at night?
I believe it's 10 o'clock. Let me be accurate. I think it's 10 to 7 in the morning. So theoretically, we were thinking as a response to go down to Jack in the Box and start making citizens' arrests, pulling elderly matrons out of their cars as they began to chow down on their Whoppers or whatever you call those Burger King things. We never did. Instead, we organized groups of people in vehicles began to meet and became part of a group called the VRA, the Vehicular Residents Association. They published a newsletter. I came up and I was eager to report it. I've always been a supporter of the Haight-Ashbury Switchboard, the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. Earlier radical groups like the White Panthers and the Haight were something that I supported. Let's see. White Panthers were a group in the 70s who armed themselves and lived in a house in the Haight, and were essentially kind of a successor to the guerrilla groups. And the other radical groups of the 60s, the Students for a Democratic Society. And, the Weathermen and the Weather People and the Weather Hoo-Ha's and so forth. And they were actually in the Haight for a long time, and they were until Mayor Feinstein, I think, did a move-type operation on them, went in and raided their household and arrested them.
Okay, you were talking about the Vehicular Residents Association or something like that?
It's the Vehicular Residents Association, which was active only for about 6 months in 1988. And they were crushed eventually by the city and disbanded by the city. They put out 3 issues of publication, and I was commuting up to San Francisco by the city authorities. Vehicles were arrested and ticketed, and people were driven away. We were going to do a slowdown downtown in the financial district during the hours when the business district is working, and we didn't quite do that. We actually threatened it, and we set up operations headquarters at Glide Memorial Church, and we were doing various kind of preparing to do it. And one guy, who was an activist both in Santa Cruz and here in San Francisco, developed a. He was going to run for supervisor at the same time and run for city council, I believe, because the races were simultaneously sort of running back and forth. His name was Ron. Anyway, I met Food Not Bombs. The question you asked was, how did you meet Food Not Bombs?
Yeah, how did you first?
The longest answer you've
heard. Well, it's interesting.
Of.
I never heard any of this about this vehicular. What is it called? The
Vehicular Residents Association.
Oh, I didn't have it right.
Yeah.
And somehow led to Food Not Bombs. Yeah.
It did. I met Keith McHenry because I heard about Food Not Bombs being arrested in the Haight because they began. Police began arresting Food Not Bombs first in small numbers, and 7 people were arrested shortly after they applied for a permit, ironically. They've been feeding people in the Haight-Ashbury once a week for every week for months, as well as, I guess, 1 or 2 days a week downtown. And somebody in the organization said, well, let's make sure we're completely legal and let's apply for a permit.
And that was
as a consequence, police showed up and began
problem.
Busting. And I think this was connected with the Coal Valley Improvement Association's campaign to clear away the hippies from the Haight and the vehicles from the Haight. That was part of that campaign. That's what that was about. So I think that in the process of that, I met him, and he was he's quite a figure. He invited me to his house, and he let me stay overnight there, and he was being arrested and beaten by police, I think, as early as 88, although the major attacks on him happened later. He As I said, first they arrested 7, then they arrested 23, then the next time they arrested 55. Every time they arrested people, more people showed up. So it became more and more ridiculous to go after those kinds of arrests.
And those were some of the massive arrests, which you were one of the over 1,000 arrests?
Those were... Those we include in the total of more than 1,000 arrests in the 1996 total. Actually, the 1,000 arrests, we've had a number of arrests this year. They were from Palo Alto, and they dropped the charges. And then, of course, the most recent arrest was a week ago when Keith McHenry himself again was arrested. That charge was dropped the next day. So the arrests continue, although presumably they've certainly scaled down since Jordan left power.
Do you think that was a freak arrest, or was that a warning signal?
Probably a freak arrest, although, again, the police force seems to have an independent life all its own in San Francisco. The arrest must come from the police department, since the district attorney's office is not really interested, I have to assume, I could be wrong, and going after food, not bombs, particularly after DA Terrence Hallinan has so eloquently spoken on my behalf, but that still declines, although I haven't really called his office. I suppose I should, again.
Call it collect.
Call collect. Yeah, actually, it's a local call, so I can I can do it locally, you know.
Did you join Food Not Bombs at that point?
Well, in a sense. I mean, there's no real formal joining process. I went to a couple of their meetings. Their meetings are interminable and go on for hours, and I've never been able to stand meetings of Food Not Bombs either in San Francisco or in Santa Cruz. In Santa Cruz, I've been more of them simply because I live in Santa Cruz, and they get very rigid. You have to sit through their meetings in order to make announcements, and I usually would come in with some flyer or other that I wanted to have announced or publicized. And Kim Margula, who was Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs woman, Candlelight Kim, as I call her, would have she and Robert Flory kind of controlled the agenda in Food Not Bombs meetings, and they would do their thing. And so I've been to a number of their meetings, and in San Francisco, I think I was brave enough to go to one meeting. I went to 2 or 3 meetings, actually, one concerning my trial.
So when you say joining Food Not Bombs, you're talking about being out in the street and
People. You go down there and you help serve free food, you help give away literature, you help transport the food, you help cook the meals. I've done all this, frankly, spottily regarding meal cooking. I haven't done that much meal cooking.
Serving than cooking.
More serving than cooking, and more being present and sort of publicizing. So when someone's arrested, you start shouting, or you tape record what's going on, or you take photos of what's happening, you simply stand around as a witness to be in solidarity with what happens. Particularly important as the war against Food Not Bombs heated up in 1993, about the time I was arrested. I was arrested for the first time with Food Not Bombs in October of 93, although I'd been arrested in the same park about 15 feet away 3 years before when we did a sleep out to oppose state law 647I, which is still in effect. It's a lodging law. It makes it illegal for you to sit down with a backpack on a park bench. They were using it. It's an 1872 law.
It's illegal to sit down on a park bench with a backpack.
Well, that's the application that was being used to attack homeless people both here in San Francisco and down south in Santa Ana.
And not school children with backpacks?
Now, school children with backpacks, as far as I know, were never arrested, strangely.
Selective enforcement there.
One might say that that is one interpretation, yes. So that we had a big camp out, a number of organizations led by the Union of the Homeless of Oakland, and Terry Messman and Dorothy King, and then Keith McHenry was also involved, and Coalition on Homelessness, Religious Witness, all these kind of pro-homeless groups got together in 1990 and sat in to try to push the legislature to change 647I. And they weren't able to do it, and we were all arrested and jailed, and eventually charges were dropped. And that's what I assumed was going to happen with my charge, my food charge, or I should say my contempt charge. They said charge against me for ladling free food in violation of the court order. But the charge was not dropped. Instead, it was taken to trial. And the deputy asked me this morning, he said, Deputy Ho, his name is Ho, he said, how come you were taken? He always talks in a loud, forthright voice. And I said, well, that's a good question. He says, you and no one else? I said, yeah. well, I said over 1,000 were eventually arrested throughout the process, but only one was ever taken to trial, said, "Well, there must be something more going on there. You might look at that again, Mr. Khan." And I said, "Well, I invite your inspection on this case, because I certainly would like to know what's going on. Was it the case of then Mayor Coonerty calling up the district attorney's office and writing another secret letter saying, prosecute this guy and get him the hell out of my hair?" I doubt it, because actually about that time, Coonerty had yielded office to Kennedy.
Oh, another big fan of yours.
Scott Kennedy has not always been on the firing lines against me. We used to be, in some senses, friendly, if not allied, on certain cases, but I suppose by 1994, when my case hit the courts, which was in February, he was no friend of mine. 1994, around New Year's, there was, as some Santa Cruzans may remember, a police-instigated riot downtown on January 1st, New Year's Eve. Police attempted to disband a drumming circle at the town clock at 12:10, 50 minutes before the infamous Yokoyama curfew goes into effect. That's the curfew that was passed to eliminate a homeless protest in 1991 under the mayorship of Jane Yokoyama.
At the town clock.
At the town clock. They turned the town clock into a, quote, park, and which you're not allowed to be after 1 o'clock at night. I think it's 1 to 5 or 1 to 7, something like that. They're posted hours now in the Santa Cruz town clock. Traditionally, it had been, of course, a protest spot. The people been there all night. We'd done many sleepouts there all night. They wanted to stop that, and just as Mayor Rodkin has recently in Santa Cruz tried to, he's got an injunction passed, tried to get a park, city hall closed, grounds closing regulation or law passed. In those days, they wanted to add additional burdens to homeless people engaging in protest, and did. And in 1994, this had a big impact when the police, apparently worried about an incident that had happened a year before, came in and with clubs and batons drawn and riot gear and started hitting people, telling them to move on, shoving them, and this produced a riot. People got angry, they started throwing bottles, and they drove the police away.
And I heard some reports about that, that the police, was that the one where the police actually circled the protesters and told them to disperse, but they had no place to go?
Well, no, the protesters much outnumbered the police force. That's why it was a really stupid move. It was headed by Lieutenant Saponi.
Patty Saponi.
Patty
Saponi. Famous...
previously Patty Reed.
The declaration that...
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, she's become famous more recently for her creative writing. We have a creative writing class here she might want to get into in court proceedings. And she, at that point, she'd become lieutenant, I'm not sure how recently. And she oversaw the police operation of the town clock, which essentially consisted of go in there and strong arm everybody out of there. Well, the result was they started throwing bottles at police cars, they hurt police officers, and then the police officers tried to herd them, and they herded them downtown, right through the main street. Some people started breaking windows. I arrived on the scene about 5 or 10 minutes after this had started, and I started interviewing the rioters, and I actually played a tape of this on Free Radio Santa Cruz last year, and I have a tape available if people are interested.
Okay, so this was the incident where the windows at Bookshop Santa Cruz were broken?
This was one incident where, I don't think Bookshop Santa Cruz windows were actually broken on that occasion, strangely enough, because Coonerty was not a favorite figure at that time. We'd actually organized against him and had a table in front of the bookshop for many, many weeks. John Hamilton had a table. That's Jack Light John Hamilton, the black Santa Cruz activist. He'd been doing a lot of petitioning to end the sleeping ban. No, windows were broken three or four months later when...
ESL!
When Coonerty...
ESL class, line upstairs, ESL!
ESL, that's
English
as a
second
language. Right. Now, they don't have Spanish as a second language here, though it might be noted that there are probably more people on the ward that speak Spanish than... Well, that may well be true. We actually have a very large Honduran population on the ward.
Hmm.
And the word on the streets, or the word here from people who are deal dope on the streets, is that Hondurans are much more reliable and honest than other dealers. So I don't know if this is true, but if it is, I suggest you check out
honest
the
dope dealers.
Oh, well, you know, just like an honest liquor salesman, it sounds like a contradiction in terms, you know.
Uh-huh.
But you have to figure what the if a person's going to keep their clientele, they need to. You know, be honest with them. They can't. It becomes a repeated thing. So, that's
consistent behavior.
Yeah, and I, in a sense, you ask me, do I consider myself a prisoner of conscience? I consider all these people, not so much prisoners of conscience, but prisoners under unjust and ridiculous laws. They're trying to help their families. The one Honduran I met today has four children. He's only 23, and he has four children.
Oh, wow.
I believe that. The oldest of which is 11.
Wasn't that a largely Catholic country?
Yes, I believe it is.
So,
Protestants are doing what they can, and I guess Rios Montt and Guatemala.
Well, with the implication that that birth control is prohibited by the church.
Yeah, I don't know how much that is actually true in Latin American countries. As far as I know, in the United States, Catholics wink at what the Pope says.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, at least that's what I hear.
The figure that I heard is 80% of American women defy the papal decree.
Right. Now, I don't know. Of course, birth control is frequently unnecessary because the paucity of females in the area. But maybe we can get you to join the ward. I have a bunk right near mine if you wish to.
Yeah, I look so good in orange.
Yes. San Francisco, we are all, kind of unisex outfits.
Let me move on to my next question.
Sure. You've learned a definitive answer to where I first met Keith McHenry.
Yeah. Like
that question was about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, well, that's all right. You can take as long as you want to answer these or answer them shortly, whatever you feel like. So, do you have any regrets over the course you have chosen?
Well, I have regrets when I think of the people that I'd like to be with. I have regrets when I think of the women in whose arms I would like to be. No question. That certainly is something I miss, and that sorely tempts me at times. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really missing anything particular in the outside world, per se, as you might think one would in jail. I at least get into a somnolent kind of state where I'm reading and writing, and I just kind of go into a trance, and another day goes away, and I kind of regret the thought that the entire period will suddenly disappear like a flash. But then, in a way, that's true with a lot of our lives, that they will disappear. You know, the road is suddenly behind you, and before it was in front of you, and suddenly you look at your hands and they're wrinkled. It's a strange thing, you know, I would imagine. But I also have some regrets that I don't have regrets. I'm somewhat cynical in terms of the amount of publicity this event, which should be generating compared to what it actually is. It's not generating much publicity. It's not having a lot of impact on the outside world.
I have for you an article from Australia.
Ah, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
There is some international publicity regarding your case. Unfortunately, I don't have any idea which
newspaper this is from,
or even the city that it's in.
Well, it says
it just says something about Tasmania
right.
in one of the advertisements. But
well, this is interesting. I mean, you might say, wow, this is halfway around the world. It's from Australia. Reportedly, I heard this paper is from, because I was informed of this by phone yesterday. And it's a little article on top of page 7, Good Samaritan Jailed Over Food. And it's a four-paragraph long article. I guess what you want to keep it, right?
So, yeah.
In 1989, when Sandy Loringer was convicted of serving free food in Santa Cruz, not for violating a court order as I was, but essentially doing the same thing, serving food to the homeless, serving food to the poor. At that time, she was on the front page of at least two or three major Indian newspapers in Bombay. She didn't get a huge headline, but she got a little story on the front page. So one wonders, is that because she had better PR? Is that because the story just broke in that way? Is that because, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that was. I don't know what caused that to happen. But she, the mayor of that town received letters from all over the world. If you go back to 1989 and ask for the mayor's records, you'll find there was just a huge amount of input there. And she only served 1 month in jail. I think she was sentenced to 45 days and served 22. And she served them all in the kitchen of the Santa Cruz County Jail, the women's facility there. And that was...
kind of a fitting punishment there?
I think that contrast with what's happened with me in that situation is kind of depressing. because I haven't received that kind of publicity, even though there's been much more preparation. Amnesty International, for instance, was a very prestigious international organization. I read a little article about Amnesty International in the Examiner today. They're reported as denouncing police abuse in New York City, which is interesting. But I heard nothing in the public, in the papers, other than in terms of an article which noted my conviction mm-hmm. of Amnesty International denouncing this continued holding of me as a political prisoner or as just a person who's committed no legitimate crime. His crime, in essence, has been to be with an organization that is verboten. I mean, that really is the bottom line. Individual women or men who are giving away free food are not going to be arrested, although occasionally they have been. But the people been arrested are people associated with Food Not Bombs. And Food Not Bombs has suffered the most extraordinary injustices in terms of people being much worse treated than I. Keith McHenry has been beaten, I believe, 10 times now. 10 times, seriously beaten. Gone to the hospital, I think, on 4 or 5 occasions by city police, and in conjunction with arrests around Food Not Bombs, where they were simply just beating the hell out of him to give him a lesson. One of them happened in 1991 at his hearing when he won a contempt of court case that's similar to the one I lost. He won it, and the consequence, the cops threw him downstairs. I saw this happen.
Wow.
It was amazing. Now, the cops haven't thrown me down the stairs. The cops have never abused me. And I don't know why. Keith is much, in a certain sense, he's more in your face than I am. Keith is
really?
Oh, yeah.
That will come to a surprise to some certain Santa Cruzians.
Oh, well. You know, myths are one thing and realities are another. McHenry is out there in your face, and he's all over the country, too. Right now he's gone to Utah, I think, to do some, not so much political work, but he's almost always on the job. He started the vigil in front of the city hall, in front of the Hall of Justice a week ago to support me. And though the Food Not Bombs group that you attended last night, the San Francisco mm-hmm. Food Not Bombs group, is picking it up, and I was glad to hear that, my understanding is it wouldn't have gone anywhere without Keith individually taking responsibility for it and doing it.
Yeah, they were out there this morning going, free oatmeal, free coffee, free Robert Norscom.
All right. Hey, keep it up, folks. You can do it. Hey, sooner the better.
Yeah. And several police officers went by, but none of them would stop for free food or free coffee.
Rarely do the police condescend to take free food, though, as I've said in past interviews, one of the curious things about my conviction and one of the pieces of evidence I presented was that on the free eats chart in San Francisco, they list that the police actually give out as a social service and supposedly as part of the positive face for the Jordan Matrix program, they would give out a chart where people could get great services, food, clothing. And near the top of the list was Food Not Bombs, Civic Center Plaza.
Wow.
And the same meal that I was giving out. And they gave this out. And the day that I was going...
Seems like a contradiction there.
It does, doesn't it? But not to those who want you jailed and want... Essentially, they want people... The authorities of San Francisco, in this case, the police, the district attorney's office, when it was controlled by Arliss Smith, the mayor's office, when it was controlled by Frank Jordan, city attorney's office, still controlled by Louise Rennie, wanted Food Not Bombs to say goodbye. And Food Not Bombs wouldn't. And this became a political, and has become a political battle, where they will not back down. It's a matter of like showing their authority, even though it would make a lot more sense for them to show their authority by simply ignoring Food Not Bombs, which is what they're doing now.
Listen up. Some stuff's a deuce class, and man is saying that's not a race class. Let's go. The producer to pick it up. Some stuff's a deuce class.
So
that's an example of someone speaking too close to the mic.
It's a way to wake up those sleeping inmates. Hey, you!
A crackly noise. I don't know what he said, but it was loud.
It was.
And I'm awake now.
Yes, it keeps you on your toes, or off your bunks. And you're either off your bunks or on your bunks, and sort of back and forth here at the beautiful F-pod here. But, go ahead.
Yeah, that kind of leads into my next question. I know this is your first time in prison. While you can't compare other prisons from your own personal experience, what is unique about the Glamour Slammer?
Oh, the Glamour Slammer. Well,
I don't, you know, it doesn't smell bad in here.
No.
It's very clean. It doesn't appear to be too overcrowded.
No, it's not overcrowded. Actually, there are beds for everyone.
Actually, you know what it kind of reminds me of, having had that brief glimpse of FPOD in there, what is it reminds me of a kind of like a spa workout club or something.
You see
41st Avenue Fitness Center.
Right, you see all the inmates.
Yeah, people in their sort of leisure suits and kind of hanging out and relaxing and not really doing any meaningful work, I imagine.
Well, the differences are, I mean, I've been on like 4 days in Santa Cruz pods, jails, and the major difference is that they don't have deputies in the jails in Santa Cruz most of the time, except they put all the inmates together behind bars, and the inmates essentially watch television and sit in their bunks, use the showers, sit at tables and play cards, you know, or get into fights, whatever they do. Or then there's a little basketball court in Santa Cruz. You go out and play basketball and so forth. They don't. I guess they have weight rooms and so forth. County jails are notoriously badly staffed, badly equipped, don't have enough facilities. Many of the cons here, even though this is called the Glamour Slammer, want out of here so they can get to a place where there's much more regular facilities, a law library they have access to. That's been one of my beefs about this joint. I got even threatened a hunger strike at one point about it, and I'm still thinking about that. I haven't got access to the law library. They say you won't get it unless you move to another jail.
Are there any plans to put in a law library here? I mean, this is a fairly new jail. It just opened up in 1995.
I talked to Markham, the third in command of the jail system, yesterday. He came by, and he said that there have been 15 lawsuits regarding the law library, and the most recent accommodation that they're using, the most recent accommodation is law students, I guess they are, paralegals coming in and sort of doing a "we'll do the research for you" sort of thing. You know, and this, of course, is completely inadequate. I mean, you need time in the law library yourself. These guys, public defenders and law researchers are pretty useless, public defenders particularly. And I've had one meeting with a law research student. I told him on yesterday that I wanted him to research a couple questions, which we've been unable to get into, like disqualifying the judge who sentenced me, Judge Barclay of Alturas, Modoc County, like determining why the law library is not accessible to inmates and what the real, I guess what I should do is ask some questions about the real demand on the law library. I would really seriously consider a hunger strike around this issue if a lot of the inmates wanted that done, even if they wouldn't join me. They probably would. Some of them probably would join in solidarity if there was a real need for it. There are problems in here. The main problem is they keep throwing more and more people into this system and building more and more prisons, essentially as a sort of a political number, a political gesture to the politicians who are winning elections through this kind of thing. The California Department of Corrections, according to a petition that I found in an old newspaper here, and I'm kind of circulating. I actually circulated a little bit, and I put it aside, and I circulated it again. Talks about the most probation violations and parole violations of more than all the 49 states combined in California. California Department of Corrections is an industry and a law unto itself, and it's just frightening. I mean, I'm meeting people, mostly people on drug offenses. There are some domestic violence cases. There are some cases, one case of aggravated assault.
Well, this is considered a very low. The types of infractions or crimes are nonviolent or not serious in this particular pod?
It's a mix. I mean, there are both people who are violent and then there are people who are nonviolent. You know, I mean, it's true. I mean, there's violence really, it's right below the surface, and it's almost happened many times. Well, not many times. That seems like several times. I mean, most of the time, I'm an extroverted kind of guy, so I just, you know, go up to people and talk and so forth and ask them, and I put a couple people on the radio through the local payphone system, which we can do. You have unusual access to the payphones.
Yeah, it's different from Santa Cruz County.
Yes, although I think you have access. No, I don't think you have direct, at least you didn't when I was last in jail for any length of time in 1988 in Santa Cruz County. I was jailed by Police Chief Bassett for false information.
False information.
Yes, he claimed the name Robert Norris was a dodge to avoid justice. My real name was Robert Norris Kahn, and that I was trying to con everybody.
The cat's out of the bag.
The cat is out of the bag. You know. So that That was the allegation. And they had four charges of false information, not just one, but four. I've been able to serve 2 years in jail for that sort of thing. And they were all dropped. But they took them through the courts, and they fucked with them for a while, you know. And they made a lot of to-do and a hickey, and it was all bogus. They wanted to eliminate me as a leader in the homeless movement at that time, because at that point I actually was popular.
People
showed up in my court hearing with a big banner in court saying "Free Robert Norris," and there was quite a hullabaloo in the courtroom in the fall of 1988.
Well, I thought it was legal to use whatever name you want as long as it's not to defraud or...
It is. And that was the reason that their cases all had to be dropped. So it was purely bogus. I was actually arrested as I walked into city council meeting in November of 1988. They didn't want... Because we've been having larger and larger demonstrations, and they wanted to stop me from... This is my assumption. I believe it's really not an unreasonable supposition. They wanted to stop me from doing that.
Why is working for the civil rights of the poor so important to you?
Well, you know, it's wrong to overemphasize the nobility of a person who happens to find himself in jail in an unusual set of circumstances. I mean, you can easily get dazzled by that and not actually see it for what it is. And that is... I mean, I've always had, as I mentioned to you earlier in this discussion, a hostility to a sense of everyone should be treated fairly in terms of their right to privacy, their right to be left alone, their right to ordinary human commerce, you know, that sort of thing. And it's just stayed with me. In a way, I wish I were doing other things, and I probably will do other things in my life rather than this. But it's probably not going to be something I'm going to forget. It's going to be something I'm going to continue to pursue.
Okay, and this is 96.3 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. And you're listening to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides from Jail. And I need to apologize in advance for the next section of tape that you'll be listening to. The sound quality varies dramatically. And there are some parts that I hope you'll suffer through. But listen in, and this is Robert Norris Kahn from County Jail 8.
Another question?
Sure, whatever. I should say that, you know, I threw myself on the tape, and I sound a little like a drill at times, you know, something you're going to pursue, and what you're doing here. It's easy to think of me as some... I read the press releases about me, here's a straight hero who's in jail. Most of these guys are in jail for much longer periods of time, and you might say, oh, well, they're there on drug offenses. But they're having huge chunks of their life taken away. So if I'm going to really be a hero, what they should do is deal with that kind of war that's going on against the well-being and the happiness and the lives of poor people. Because almost 95%, I haven't found anybody who's rich in jail. You know, I try to find anybody who's middle class. It's a poor man's jail. They're mostly black and Hispanic. Or in this case, Honduran. A lot of Hondurans here. You know, occasionally Chinese-American. I was telling you about a Chinese-American youth who's held here on a fireworks charge, $35,000 bail for $100 worth of fireworks, felony conspiracy, and everything going through the minor, and this is an 18-year-old person, you know, just incredible, just preposterous. So the hero, I don't know, the heroes are going to be those who effectively move to dismantle this system and really change it and get past the political shift that passes for leadership, where you have Governor Wilson now hustling the retailer of three strikes law so that DAs can essentially write the rules for people, and a third felony, which is nothing more serious than a drug crime of some sort without any violence, can be the basis for a life term in prison. I talked to a man yesterday who's going to San Quentin. His name is Raphael. I'm hoping to get him on the air.
Who's going to San Quentin? because he was found with a gun, an illegal attempt to sell a gun and heroin or something, which, you know, I suppose sounds bad to the average middle American, but there are plenty of gun shops that sell guns, and there are plenty of pharmacies and alcohol stores that sell drugs that are much more dangerous than alcohol, for instance, than heroin. And yet this man gets his entire life taken away from him. He'll probably either do violence to people in those jails or have violence done to him. And he's a tough guy. You know, he's the kind of guy that you see stereotyped in the movies. He's nice enough to me, and you know, we were friendly to each other and hoping to have an interview. But this system destroys lives. It eats them up. And it eats them up so that guards can have salaries and politicians can make elections.
And it's not just the prisoners' lives themselves, but their families and their loved ones are denied having that person in their network of support. And it's a lot of times that since there's a predominance of men in jail, those are usually the prime wage earners. And it's a very brutal system that doesn't... And the recidivism rate for people who have been incarcerated is very high.
Yeah, in a way that makes me cynical in a certain sense. I'm talking to guys who I regard as friends and so forth, in the sense that they're friendly to me and we do favors for each other on the ward, and yet they're going to be back in jail probably soon for smoking crack or selling dope or something like that. I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I'm glad that people who are engaging in domestic violence are removed from that setting. But what's happened is they're just sitting in jail. One guy, my cellmate, has been sitting in jail for 4 months. 4 months, you know. And actually, he's there for aggravated assault, which I guess is something a little different. I mean, he's a stranger kind of guy. He's kind of,
well, yeah, I can understand, like assault or, if you're beating people up or if you're using a weapon in a crime or something. That's dangerous.
But, more than 50% are here. In fact, probably more like 80% are here for drug crimes or drug-related crimes. And, of course, all the prisoners will go, I did the crime, and therefore... Often these people who are here will not say, I'm a victim of the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
They will admit that, they've adopted the point of view that it is somehow their fault and their responsibility for being here. And in a certain sense, you can say, yeah, you should have paid attention to this crazy tangle of laws that, you can easily fall foul of. In another sense, it's the net itself that is obviously the problem, and not the people. And that's why it's all a big sham. It's all a big waste of time. All this stupid shouting, talking back and forth, and you go to your cell, and the whole system of programs is bullshit. I mean,
it accomplishes no good. It does not make society safer, because once the people get out, they're actually more likely to commit crimes than when they went in.
Well, it's
and
not
most people do get out.
Well, it's not going to stop people from doing drugs.
And I know that you're concerned about homeless issues a lot. Do you find that people who maybe had homes that wind up in jail, when they're released, they are homeless as a result of the incarceration?
That's a good question. You've asked me that before, and I should do more research on that. If you put that question to me in a week and remind me, I will do some research on that. I know that when I first got in, I was told repeatedly by several inmates that over half the cellmates were homeless people, and that they themselves had been homeless before they came in. In a certain sense, this is a program for giving them some kind of gives you a roof, over your head, So that's something. And that's, that's good. But on the other hand, it's deadening in here. I mean, I guess, you get, there's some, they call them classes, they're creative writing classes, and that's,
mm-hmm.
that's good. I'm in a creative writing class. I've written a couple of items, and I get to hear, as I mentioned to you on the phone, about drive-by shootings. People talk about how they got
mm-hmm.
shot, and it's interesting.
Uh-huh.
You get real-life experiences rather than TV shit, which gets you at least some background in how at least some people have experienced the violent side of, direct violent side of what you often see caricatured or
mm-hmm.
sensationalized on television.
I know you don't watch much television, or maybe you have started to since you've been here.
No,
but a lot of these, there is a glamorization of police and that they're fighting the bad guys. And
oh, and the same glamorization happens here, though the inmates usually root for the criminals.
Oh, really?
It's kind of funny. We saw Heat the other day, the movie Heat with Al Pacino and De Niro. And De Niro is the hero, and Pacino is regarded as sort of a snitch, scumbag. And,
uh-huh.
And so, but the whole focus in prison life is, you know, on comes things like television and having your chair near the front, if you like television, or having your food being at the front of the line. We almost had a fight yesterday about people being in line for the food. My roommate, who's a Honduran guy.
You have a room?
Well, we have you have an enclosure. I don't know if you noticed when you walked in, all along the wall there are kind of pods. Each of them has up two bunks and then two chairs, and you have a sort of a kind of an upper and a downer sort of thing. There are four people in a pod. You're like peas in a pod or puds in a pod, as we call ourselves out here in the glamour slammer.
Uh-huh.
So people are.
So there are four bunks in each.
There are two bunks. Yeah, there are four beds.
Is that,
two bunks.
You call that a cell?
That's sort of a, yeah, your.
Or your room.
Your
or
room. Go to your bunks. That's sort of thing. Go to your bunks. So it's pretty much a bunch of bunks. So you get to go to your bunks.
Mm-hmm.
So people, you know, your focus is around food. Your focus is around your mail. Your focus. They remove these privileges. You focus on being able to find the newspaper to read. They occasionally get to read the paper. Your focus is around. You're only allowed three books in your cell, your enclosure. They wink at that occasionally. I was able to get by with seven books. The deputy did a search of my cell today, right before you arrived. He saw me going into my. Each of us has a locked shelf we get to use. You put a lock on it. If you don't have a lock on it, they'll take all your stuff. Not the inmates, but the guards. They'll take all your stuff and say you're disobeying the rule.
Oh wow.
Or let's put it this way: they threaten to take all your stuff. I haven't actually seen that happen yet.
Uh-huh.
And they. I will say this for the deputies. You were asking earlier the differences between this and the Santa Cruz jail. Here they have deputies on a raised